funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What hope is there for harmony in the Middle East, and specifically for tranquility between Israelis and Palestinians? As a journalist based in Jerusalem, Matthew Kalman has been covering the region for nearly two decades, researching everything from ancient history to up-to-the-minute developments in on-again, off-again peace negotiations. Matthew Kalman is in town to speak tonight to the annual meeting of the American Jewish Committee. His speech is called Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, Combating the War Against Israel's Right to Exist. Matthew, welcome to Think.
Good morning. Pleased to be here.
So you're speaking tonight on the movement to boycott Israeli universities. Tell us a little bit about how this started and what the intentions were.
The boycott campaign essentially started in 2005 when a long list of Palestinian academics, intellectuals and cultural leaders signed a manifesto calling on their supporters throughout the world to impose a cultural and academic boycott in Israel because of its policies towards the Palestinians and specifically its policies towards the settlements on the West Bank and the barriers that they posed towards the creation of a Palestinian state. And since 2005, we've seen the gradual spread of this academic boycott campaign, first specifically in Britain and in Europe, and now it's also spread to the United States as well. And last year, the Asian Studies Association here in America became the first national academic body to pass a boycott resolution at its annual meeting last year. It's since been followed by the American Studies Association, and there was another motion at the Modern Languages Association in January that was narrowly defeated. But as well as that, we've had student governments debating the issue of the boycott in campuses across America over the last two or three years, and it's something that's really gaining an awful lot of traction.
So it's gaining traction, but the debate remains. For people who think this is not a good idea or that the boycott is misplaced, what are their concerns?
My concerns are whether the people who are involved in the campaign and who are running the campaign and who are fronting the campaign at different campuses across America really understand the implications of what they're saying. Because to supporters of Israel and to Jewish communities in America, the majority of whom are firmly opposed to any idea of a boycott, although there is a small minority within the Jewish community that also supports a boycott. This whole talk of a boycott raises extremely difficult and unpleasant memories for supporters of Israel on two grounds. First of all, because any time you talk about a boycott connected with Jews, immediately Jewish thoughts go back to the Nazi boycott of German goods in the 1930s. I'm not saying there's any connection between the two, but that's what very, very deep in the sort of Jewish cultural and historical psyche, and it raises very, very nasty memories for people in the Jewish community. And the other thing that the boycott does is that it singles out Israel as a pariah state. And quite simply, there hasn't been another country in the world, apart from apartheid South Africa, where there's been a concerted cultural and academic boycott campaign of this kind. And the Israelis turn round and their supporters turn round and say, we are not an apartheid state. We're not like South Africa. We don't have those kind of segregation laws. We don't deny the vote to the non-Jewish citizens of Israel. You know, how can you dare to compare us to apartheid South Africa? They feel it's a very, very deep insult and that they feel is a form of real hatred towards Israel and towards most of the Jewish community that supports Israel. And I'm not sure that the people in the boycott campaign realize how deeply felt those emotions are. From their point of view, what they're doing is quite legitimate. What they're doing is they are protesting in a nonviolent, democratic, political manner against what they see as the Israeli oppression of the Palestinians. What could be wrong with that? And from their point of view, it seems entirely legitimate. But there's a complete mismatch between what the boycott campaigners are trying to do and the way they're trying to do it and the way that it's perceived by Israel supporters and by, as I say, the vast majority of the Jewish community.
So if the response has been in Israel, the sense that they are being unfairly persecuted, is it safe to assume that this is not having any impact on Israeli policy toward the Palestinians?
It's having no impact whatsoever towards Israeli policy, towards the Palestinians. And in fact, there is a very small minority of Palestinian academics who are also opposed to the boycott. And they say that the reason that they are opposed to it is because as academics, they don't believe in boycotts. They think boycotts are wrong from the get-go. And that the whole point of being an academic is to broaden your mind, to engage with people who may disagree with you, to engage with the other, even if you perceive them as your enemy. And so they are fundamentally ideologically opposed to the idea of a boycott of any kind. And they also say it's completely useless in terms of the effect that it will have on Israel and Israeli policies. So why betray our academic principles of open-mindedness and engagement for something that's not going to work anyway? As I say, that's very much a minority opinion among Palestinian academics. I would say the vast majority of Palestinian academics are very much in favor of the boycott.
If this continues gaining ground, do you imagine that some action might be taken to stop it? And I don't know that I don't know what Israel could do to stop it.
I don't know what Israel could do to stop it either. And it's not really something that Israel can stop. You know, this is a political debate that's taking place in an American professors' union or in a British trade union or a local government council somewhere. So it's not something that the Israelis have any control over. But I think it's something that is a growing issue for Israel, and that Israel and its supporters need to look at this very carefully. They need to look at the effect that it's having on Israel's image around the world. They need to look at the potential effects on Israel's economy and its cultural ties, its academic ties. And they need perhaps to rethink how they are approaching this whole issue.
So let's talk about the breakdown of the most recent round of Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. President Obama has called this stalemate a pause. Is that accurate, or is that the understatement of the decade?
It's the understatement of the century. I'm not proud of the fact that I was one of the commentators who a year ago predicted that this round of peace talks would go nowhere. I'm very unhappy to have been proved right about that. I wish that the Kerry Initiative and the Obama Initiative would have produced something, but it was absolutely clear that it wasn't going to go anywhere. And there are many complex reasons for that. But for me, the fundamental reason was that this was a process that was imposed on the Israelis and the Palestinians, that neither side was ready for this peace process, and that the preparations that were made for it, therefore, were not adequate to support a successful conclusion. And it seemed to have been done far more for the convenience of American politics and an American political timetable than the politics or the timetable of either the Israelis or the Palestinians. And it's a very dangerous thing, because the problem, if you raise people's expectations and then you disappoint them, is that people will react. And we know that in the Middle East, people react with violence. And this is exactly what happened in the year 2000. And I'm old enough to have been reporting back in the year 2000. And there we knew that the Second Intifada was coming after the breakdown of the Camp David talks in the summer of 2000. And it came just 2 or 3 months later. And the danger is that an Intifada that wasn't brewing a year ago may well be brewing now, because the Palestinians feel that another round of peace talks has collapsed. It's left them without hope. And they'll say, well, what are we supposed to do? And the fear is that a new generation of young Palestinians may now turn to violence in order to express their frustration at the lack of progress towards independence and statehood. So it may have been better if the administration had never embarked on this process to begin with.
Your point is well taken that imposing these talks on both sides externally is not going to put people necessarily in a position to speak productively to one another. I wonder, though, if this has to be all or nothing, if there's not a route that says, OK, maybe we're not ready for permanent agreements, but we can look at smaller issues that might at least sort of grease the wheels and make things easier the next time you go into a really high level round of negotiations.
That is the obvious hope, isn't it? That, okay, if we can't have a full peace, let's at least agree on this aspect, trade or culture or where the barriers are going to be, how the exchange of people working every day, just ease people's lives. The problem is that the Israelis and the Palestinians have been locked into exactly that process for the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. And the Oslo process, which began with very, very high hopes, with that great signature on the White House lawn with Bill Clinton and Arafat and Rabin signing that historic declaration of principles, and really turning over an amazing new leaf, in which instead of fighting each other, the Israelis and the Palestinians would sit down, they'd negotiate with each other. This was supposed to be a 5-year interim process, which would involve what were called confidence-building measures. And that's really what you're talking about. Confidence-building measures, people-to-people programs, trade, visits, joint working parties on all sorts of different things. And the idea was that as the Palestinians and the Israelis got used to talking to each other instead of killing each other, then they would be more ready to then sit down and trust each other a little bit more when it came to dealing with the difficult issues on the table in terms of the hard political decisions that need to be taken to achieve peace, where to draw the borders, how to work out Jerusalem, what's going to happen with the refugees, what happens with security measures. Those are the tough issues. And the thought was, if you sit together and you have cultural exchanges and you have trade relations and you have business relations, then it'll be much easier then to trust each other when it comes to making the very difficult compromises that have to be made on both sides on all those difficult issues. But that 5-year process has become a 20-year process. It's been punctuated by the most appalling violence from both sides during the process. We've seen the Palestinians splinter into two between Hamas controlling Gaza and Fatah controlling the West Bank. And 20 years into the Oslo process, there's a feeling that the Israelis and the Palestinians are no closer to peace than they were back at the start. If anything, they might even be further away. So the experiment of these confidence-building measures, let's try and get on a little bit in this way or that way, has failed. And the problem, one of the problems with the Kerry initiative was that he went down exactly that same route. His first major speech about this last summer was talking all about the economic benefits of a future peace agreement and a $4 billion investment program that would create jobs and that would create an exchange of trade and culture and all the rest of it that would benefit both Israelis and Palestinians. They would learn to live together. It didn't work last time, and there's no particular reason why it would work this time. There needs to be some bold new idea, a new approach, new initiatives, because the Oslo approach of incremental confidence-building measures simply hasn't worked.
We're speaking this hour to journalist Matthew Kalman. He's in town to speak tonight to the annual meeting of the American Jewish Committee. His speech is called Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, Combating the War Against Israel's Right to Exist. Join the conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can learn to navigate the ever-changing digital landscape with the Social Media and Digital Communication Bootcamp, June 4th through 6th at SMU in Plano. Details and registration at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour to foreign correspondent Matthew Kalman. He is based in Jerusalem. He's in town to speak tonight to the annual meeting of the American Jewish Committee. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. I want to go back for just a minute, Matthew. This idea of things as simple as cultural exchanges, which now, with 2020 hindsight, we look at and say they really helped thaw maybe the first few snowflakes in the Cold War. One important difference that doesn't get talked about very much is that the U.S. and the Soviet Union were not quite literally living on top of one another, as is the situation with the Israelis and Palestinians. Do you think that's a factor in the fact that both sides are quick to have their frustrations reignited by the other?
The thing that always fascinates me about the Israelis and Palestinians is how well they know each other and how little they know each other all at the same time. So, for example, you have a whole generation of Palestinian leaders who grew up in Israeli prisons. They were arrested during the first intifada that began back in the 1980s. One of the most famous names there is Marwan Barghouti, who is now in prison in Israel on multiple murder counts from the second intifada. All the polls show that if he were released tomorrow, he would be elected as the next president of Palestine. But he was originally arrested, I think, when he was as young as 16 or 17, for throwing stones at Israeli army jeeps. He grew up in Israeli prisons. It means he speaks Hebrew fluently. Hmm. He reads the Israeli newspapers. He understands the Israeli television. There's a whole generation of Palestinian leaders in their 40s and 50s who speak Hebrew, who understand Israelis, who understand Israeli politics probably better than I do. So you have the same on the Israeli side, not because they've been in Palestinian prisons, but because they've actually been in the security services in Israel. They've been in military intelligence and in the secret intelligence service, and they speak fluent Arabic, and they're the guys interrogating these guys. And it's very interesting to see the relationships that have grown up between these enemies who, I wouldn't say they've become friends, but they certainly speak to each other and they understand each other. That's on the one hand. But on the other hand, you have vast gaps in the cultural knowledge and the sensitivities of the other side. On both sides, which are surprising because they live so close together. And I'll give you a couple of examples. I recently broke a story about a Palestinian professor at Al-Quds University who became the first Palestinian professor to take his Palestinian students, to the Auschwitz-Birkenau death camp in Poland. And the reason that he did that is because he says that in order to understand my enemy, the Israelis, and that's how he says it, my enemy, the Israelis, I know how important the Holocaust is in the Israeli mindset, how vulnerable it makes them feel, how they're scared that it might happen again. How when they look at a nuclear Iran, all they can think about is well, Hitler tried to destroy the Jews, and now the Iranians are trying to destroy Israel in the same way. That's what Israelis see when they look at an Iran trying to acquire nuclear weapons. And what Professor Tajani says is, I don't agree with that. But that's what the Israelis are thinking. And in order to engage with my enemy, the Israelis, I have to understand why the Holocaust plays such a large part in their psyche. So he took this group of Palestinian students to Auschwitz-Birkenau just a few weeks ago. And since he got back, he's been absolutely lambasted and insulted and threatened with dismissal because he dared to do that. Because in Palestinian society, the Holocaust is seen as an instrument of Zionist propaganda. Hmm. And so there's this complete disconnect between how the Israelis view the Holocaust and how the Palestinians view the Holocaust. And you have the same the other way around. I'll give you an example. We hear an awful lot about the West Bank settlements. And these are areas of Israeli Jewish settlement in the West Bank, which was the land captured by Israel from Jordan in the 1967 war. It's the place where the Palestinians want to have their independent state. The Israelis have encouraged the development of small villages and settlements throughout the West Bank. There's now more than 350,000 Israelis who live on the West Bank, and that's outside East Jerusalem, which is another question altogether. But in the rest of the West Bank, 350,000 people. The Israelis view this as the biblical heartland of the Jewish people. They view this as very important for Israel's security. But the Palestinians view them as illegal interlopers on the area that they want as their state. And the Israelis don't understand why the Palestinians are so upset about these settlers being there. And the Palestinians don't understand how the Israelis can possibly not understand their feelings. And as far as the Palestinians are concerned, those settlements are destroying any chance of there being a Palestinian state on the West Bank. And that's why they're so opposed to them. And there's, again, a complete disconnect in the understanding on both sides of that equation. So, yes, Israelis and Palestinians do know each other. They do speak each other's language. They do have a lot of contact. But at the same time, they haven't really got to grips with the fundamental issues that each side holds as very, very important.
You have called the West Bank separation barrier, which runs over like 400 miles of territory as it winds around, one of the largest, most expensive planning disasters in history. First of all, what do Israelis and what do Palestinians see as its intended purpose?
Well, the separation barrier, I'm using that phrase, I'm trying to be neutral about the phrase because the Palestinians call it an apartheid wall. The Israelis say, well, most of it, 90% of it isn't a wall, it's a fence. So they call it the security fence. I'm going to call it a separation barrier, and I don't mean any judgment one way or the other when I say that. And it was built very reluctantly by the Israelis. During the Second Intifada, you had these waves of suicide bombers and attackers coming into Israel from the West Bank, killing as many as 100 Israelis a month at the height of the suicide bombings in 2002, 2003. I should say immediately that many more Palestinians were killed by Israeli military action than Israelis were killed by Palestinian action. But this was something that the Israelis could not tolerate. And after trying to stop these suicide bombers and other attackers coming into Israel, onto the buses and the cafes and the restaurants of Israel, they finally built this separation, security, whatever you want to call it, barrier and fence. And they did it very reluctantly because they were scared that this would create a political statement on the ground, that they would basically be saying everything the other side of the fence, well, you know, Israel has given up hope, mm-hmm. of Israelis ever living there or anything like that. They didn't want to make that political statement. They built it very reluctantly. And it was designed, they thought they were building a security barrier to keep out terrorists. The Palestinians look at the root of that security barrier and they say, well, this doesn't go along the 1967 border. The pre-1967 border. This goes along, this goes inside Palestinian territory. And it's actually a land grab because it doesn't just protect Israel, it also protects an awful lot of the settlements that Israel has planted in the West Bank. They say it's a political statement, it's a land grab. And not only that, but because of the route of the fence, which is very, very complicated as it winds around the hillsides and it winds around these different settlements, it actually surrounds some Palestinian villages on three sides. And now they can't get to the neighboring Palestinian village. There's one that I know quite well, which is a Palestinian village called Jayus, which is near another Palestinian town called Qalqilya. It used to be a 5-minute journey. It's now a journey that takes an hour and a half because they have to go all the way around the security barrier. There are checkpoints, there are roadblocks, there are military inspections of vehicles. And whereas before, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, you could move really quite easily just from the West Bank into Israel. Now you can't. You have to go through a military checkpoint. You have to have your car searched. You have to show your papers. It's become quite difficult for Palestinians to move around. So the Palestinians see the wall as an act of oppression. The Israelis see it as an act of defense and security. And there's a complete mismatch of the way each side sees that simple physical object.
And is it essentially a permanent thing at this point? I mean, under what circumstances could it be dismantled barring a full and permanent peace agreement?
I don't believe it is a permanent thing. The problem with it is that it looks permanent. And so you have this flood of reporters and writers and authors and artists and filmmakers and politicians going, and the Pope this week, standing next to the wall. And the wall looks permanent because it's 30 foot high and it's built of concrete and it's got these funky watchtowers in it that look like giant chess pieces from some futuristic scenario. It looks very permanent. And the problem is that when you go and see it and you take a snapshot of how it looks now, it not only looks permanent, but it looks like it was always there. And you cannot imagine now Bethlehem, for example. You can't imagine what it was like before the wall was there, and you can't imagine it after the wall's going to be taken down. But it's clearly, to my mind, not permanent. It is clearly a temporary measure implemented by the Israelis as a rather brusque and rather damaging response to this wave of suicide bombers that were coming in 10 years ago. And the problem is that the barrier, as well as a very radical change in Palestinian politics that put an end to the bombing campaign, and also a great increase in Israeli military intelligence, where they now know what the bombers are going to be doing it almost before they're doing it themselves. They're going in every night to the West Bank and arresting terrorist suspects that they think are about to carry out bombings. So those three factors together mean that there haven't been any suicide bombings in Israel for almost the last 10 years. So people go and visit it now, and it looks like an anachronism. Why is this huge wall here cutting off Palestinians, sometimes from their own farmland? Why is it here? Everything's quiet. There aren't any suicide bombings. And, of course, the Israelis turn around and say, well, the reason there aren't any suicide bombings is because of the wall. So it's, you know, it's a difficult equation, but I think it's a temporary measure, and I think as soon as there is a political solution, it will go. It will have to go as part of the political solution. And the reason I say that is because there were similar, not exactly the same, and they were in the middle of the desert, so you didn't really see them, but there were similar security measures when Israel occupied the Sinai Peninsula in order to stop the Egyptians from invading the Sinai Peninsula when Israel controlled it, as it did for 20 years. So I think there is a precedent for Israel removing very expensive, apparently permanent security measures in order to try and you know, in order to implement a peace agreement. Sorry, not 20 years. It was only about 10 years.
The Vatican went to great lengths to say that the Pope's visit this past week was not political in any way. However, when you visit that part of the world and you're choosing your agenda, it's really hard to keep everyone in the world from reading political meaning into absolutely everything you do.
With all due respect to the Vatican, it was a very political visit, and they knew it was a very political visit. The Vatican is very political when it comes to the Middle East. It's very political when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and that's their right. They can be as political as they like. I think it's slightly disingenuous of them to say that they're not being political. And I'll give you just one example, which is that there was a conference held for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, the BDS movement that we were talking about before. That conference was held in Bethlehem University, which is a Vatican university. And that's a conscious decision taken by a Vatican university to host that conference. It means they back the conference, they support the conference. The head of the university came to the conference and said how much he supported it and gave it the blessing of the Catholic Church. So to say that the Vatican and the Pope are not political when they're talking about the importance of a two-state solution is just nonsense, quite frankly. And by saying that they believe in a two-state solution, they're actually taking a political stance that many Palestinians would disagree with, because there are many Palestinians now who are saying that the time for the two-state solution, Israel and Palestine sitting side by side, that time has passed. That's not the right solution anymore. So by actually backing a two-state solution in Palestine, the Vatican was throwing their political weight behind the current Palestinian leadership. And that was a very political thing to do in terms of internal Palestinian politics, let alone Israeli-Palestinian politics.
How much does what the Pope say really matter, unless, you know, if one side or the other perceives the Vatican to be on its side, certainly they will take it and enjoy the endorsement. But what he has to say, what he does, doesn't affect policy.
Almost nothing that is said by anybody outside the Middle East affects policy in between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And that's a lesson that world leaders, including President Obama, including President Bush, including President Clinton, including Tony Blair and everybody else, it's a lesson that they refuse to learn. The Israelis and the Palestinians, the Israelis and the rest of the Arab world, are embroiled in a conflict that has been going on for decades. And it moves to a rhythm that is completely different to the rhythm of Western politics and the rhythm of the rest of international diplomacy. And the world leaders who try and help or meddle or impose their views on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict have all come away with their tail between their legs. Clinton tried it and failed. Bush tried it and failed. Obama has tried it and failed. And the reason is because the Middle East moves to a different beat. It's just that simple. I would say on one leg that the motivating factor behind politics in the democratic West is economic. Politics is about the budget. It's where are you going to spend the tax dollars? Are you going to spend them on education? Are you going to spend them on health? Are you going to spend them on building roads? Are you going to spend them on employment? It's all about the economy. It's the economy, stupid. That's what it's all about. And about how you raise that money. Who do you tax and where do you tax and how do you tax? When it comes to the Middle East, the economy is not the motivating factor for politics. Politics in the Middle East is motivated by things that in the rest of the world are seen as strange and obscure and even medieval. Politics in the Middle East are motivated by religion. They're motivated by culture. They're motivated by history. And that's very difficult to suddenly try and impose your will on those long-term historical factors.
My guest is Jerusalem-based correspondent Matthew Kalman. He's in town to speak tonight to the annual meeting of the American Jewish Committee. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can email think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, communication, piano, and Portuguese. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Matthew Kalman. His books include The Murder of Yasser Arafat and Psycho Bibi. He's in town to speak tonight to the annual meeting of the American Jewish Committee, and you can join us at 1-800-933-5372. You were speaking before the break about the fact that the things that really motivate political action are very different in the Middle East than they are in many other parts of the world that, say, an American audience would be familiar with.
That's right. You have in the Middle East people who are prepared to go and live on a hilltop as Israelis, surrounded by Palestinians who hate them, and settle and live in a caravan in the most appalling conditions because they think that God told them to go and do that. You have people who are prepared to go and kill other people because they think God told them to do that. And we're not talking about a minority of people. We're talking about a majority of the people who live in the Middle East, where religion is not a part-time exercise. It's not like being a sports fan and that's your team and you support them for a couple of hours on a Sunday morning or a Saturday morning, and then the rest of the week you worry about everything else. For the people of the Middle East, be they Jews, be they Christians, be they Muslims, their religion is something that informs everything they do. It informs the food that they eat, the person that they choose to marry. It informs the place where they live. It informs everything they do. Israel is a country that is made up of Jewish people who decided to pick up their lives and move, you know, halfway across the world in order to live in another country because they belonged to a particular religion. And that is a motivating factor that just doesn't occur in Western politics. And so unless you understand that about Israel, unless you understand that motivation of the people who live in Israel, then you can't understand Israel. And the same goes for Hamas. Hamas is not just another terrorist organization. Hamas is not the Bader-Meinhof group. Hamas is an organization that speaks to the fundamental beliefs of Muslims in Palestinian society. It talks to them, to their culture. It talks to their history. It talks to their belief in God. And that's why Hamas is so much more than just another political party. And that's why the problems with dealing with Hamas and saying, well, they can change their policy. It's not policy. It's the word of God. So how can they change it? It's a very, very difficult thing to come to terms with. It's a very difficult thing to try and squeeze through the cheesecloth of Western liberal politics.
So, Matthew, is peace in the region contingent on tens of millions of people arriving at a different interpretation of the will of God?
It may well be. It may well be. There is this hope that as you westernize and liberalize the Middle East, and I mean, this is what Obama was talking about when he went to Cairo University in 2009 and he began his outreach to the Arab and Islamic world, and he started talking about democracy and freedom and economic development. And there's this Western hope that if you just plant enough satellite dishes and fast food restaurants in the Middle East, then somehow they'll all just become westernized and everything will be okay because they'll just want to listen to pop music all day. But the fact is that they planted those satellite dishes in throughout the Middle East, and what we got was Al Jazeera. And Al Jazeera is a news network that actually reinforces the religious ideas and the religious ideology of the people of the Middle East. So it doesn't always work that way. And what's needed when it comes to the Middle East is not to see it as simply another state of the European Union or of the United States. It's a completely different place with completely different motivations. And you either need to go, you either need to attack, not to attack, sorry, to engage people on their own level, in terms of their religion, in terms of their culture, in terms of their heritage, or what you need is some revolutionary new visionary that's going to come out of the Middle East, who's going to lead those people into the promised land of peace by showing them a different way to do things, but that is still in harmony with their religion and culture. And I don't see that happening at the moment, but I think that's what it's going to take.
Does it have to be simultaneous leaders on both sides? There will not be a single unifying figure, surely.
I think it does have to be simultaneous leaders on both sides. I think you need somebody, if we're talking about the Israelis and the Palestinians, you need a leader on each side of that conflict who is going to be able to turn around and say to their own people, look, guys, these are the tough compromises that we have to make. The Israelis are going to have to say, we can't keep all these settlements on the West Bank. We can't control Jerusalem as the sole controllers of Jerusalem. We're going to have to share it with the Palestinians. They're going to have to say, we have to allow some of these refugees to come back into what is now Israel. Probably not all the refugees, but some of the refugees. We have to make some sort of gesture because that's so fundamentally important to the Palestinians, the return of the 4 million or so refugees who are the descendants of the people who left in 1948 when Israel was founded. And on the Palestinian side, you need somebody who's going to be able to say to the Palestinians, we're not going to get back the whole of the pre-1967 territory. We won't return to the pre-1967 borders before the Six-Day War. We're not going to get the full return of all 4 million Palestinian refugees to what is now Israel, to their former homes, because if they were to do that, they'd simply vote Israel out of existence, and the Israelis are not going to let that happen. There has to be somebody who's going to turn around and say that clearly to their own people on both sides. And at the moment, Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, and Abbas, the Palestinian president, they've hinted at this, but they've never gone all the way and said those bold, visionary, revolutionary things that need to be said. And so maybe we have to wait for the next leaders. Maybe they'll be brave and bold, maybe stupid enough to do it.
Well, if it's not already clear to people listening, it's no simple thing to bring everybody under the same tent, even among the Palestinians and among the Israelis. Can you talk about how both Abbas and Netanyahu deal with dissent, with differing ideas, and with the pushback that they get from their own people when they make even these hints?
Well, let me give one example from Abbas, the Palestinian president, in a sort of trial balloon about the refugee issue, which is of fundamental importance to the Palestinians, because those refugees are spread throughout the Middle East. They're in Syria, where they've been appallingly treated during the civil war. Many, many of them been killed. They've been turned into refugees again. Now in Jordan, there are Palestinian refugees in Jordan, there are Palestinian refugees in Lebanon. The Palestinian refugees in Lebanon are banned from having Lebanese citizenship. They're not allowed to join the professional classes in about, I think it's 40 or 50 different professions they're not allowed to have because they're Palestinian refugees. So they really are in a very tough situation. And Abbas himself, the Palestinian president, is a refugee. He came from a village inside what is now Israel in the north. And he said in a television interview, he said, "I realize that I won't be able to go back to my village." And this was taken as a very important statement for the first time, the Palestinian leader saying, "No, I'm giving up on my right of return that the Palestinians are very invested in." And he was slammed for doing that. He was attacked from all sides, and he quickly dialed it back and said, "No, I was just talking in a personal capacity. I was just talking about me. I wasn't saying that as a principle for Palestinian refugees." So he's really living on the edge there, trying to push things forward. But every time he does, he gets such blowback that he's not able to take it forward. He doesn't really have the backing to do that. He doesn't really have the mandate to do that. And on the Israeli side, we have Benjamin Netanyahu, who says in principle that he is in favor of a two-state solution. But at the same time, he has a very right-wing coalition who are absolutely invested in expanding the settlements on the West Bank. The settlements on the West Bank are viewed by the Palestinians and the international community as being a fundamental obstacle to the creation of a two-state solution. So how can you be on the one hand in favor of a two-state solution, on the other hand in favor of expanding the settlements? But Netanyahu is caught between these two principles. We don't know what he really believes.
Before we run out of time in this hour, I did promise that we would talk about the reporting you have done about how Yasser Arafat died. And I hate to ask you, because I know that you've made the point that it's very hard to sort of dial this into a very short piece of reporting. But can you talk about how you began to investigate this and what you learned?
We wrote a book called The Murder of Yasser Arafat after tests were carried out on his bones and on his clothing that seemed to show the presence of polonium-210, which is a radioactive poison that was also used to kill Soviet dissidents in Britain after Arafat died. Mm-hmm. So at the time that he died, it wasn't even suspected.
Right.
And then subsequent to that, his clothing was tested about a year ago, and traces of what could be the results of polonium were found on them. And then his bones were tested, and those were sent out to three different laboratories, and the results that came back were very mixed. And some of the laboratories said, yes, it looks like there was polonium. Some of them said there was no polonium poisoning. It was very, very mixed between the different laboratories. But what fascinated me was that on the day that his bones were exhumed in Ramallah about 18 months ago, I was standing with Palestinians and asking them what they felt. And ordinary Palestinians, Palestinian fighters who had fought alongside Yasser Arafat when he was under siege by the Israeli military during the Second Intifada, and even people who'd known him for years, his security chiefs, they were all absolutely convinced that he was murdered. And not only were they convinced that he was murdered, they were absolutely convinced that he must have been murdered by other Palestinians. Mm. Because those were the only people who were with him and who had the opportunity to do it. And that's what we investigated in the book. We asked the question, if he was murdered, then who could possibly have done it? And we came across an official Palestinian investigation into the murder that was halted just a couple of years after his death, because it seemed to be getting too close to the truth. And what we've tried to do is to resurrect that original investigation and see where it led.
So you're based in Jerusalem. Can you talk a little bit about people, about where you live, for people who have not been to that part of the world and see headline after headline that indicates that, that life there is really miserable all the time?
Well, there is one thing that Israelis and Palestinians agree on, and that is that Jerusalem is one of the most beautiful cities in the world. It's an extraordinary place with a walled old city that is just about 1 square mile that contains the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is holy to Muslims. It's where the Prophet Muhammad ascended to heaven. Those are built on the site of Solomon's Temple, the outer side of which is known as the Western or Wailing Wall, which is the most sacred site for Jews. And then just through the twisting alleys of the Shuk and the Old Market, just a little on the opposite hill, you have the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is the traditional site of the crucifixion and the burial of Jesus Christ. So you have the world's three monotheistic religions with three of their holiest sites within this extraordinary city that, whose walls was were built 500 years ago, that was conquered by Richard the Lionheart with the Crusaders, that was conquered by Salah ad-Din with the Muslim warriors, who was conquered by the Greeks and the Romans and the Babylonians, that was the city of King David. It's an extraordinary place that is laced across the biblical hillsides that you read about in the Old and the New Testament. If you read about Jesus in Jerusalem, this is where he walked. If you read about King David and King Solomon and the prophets, this is where they lived. And so it's an extraordinary place that's replete with history and culture and religion, that's obviously a place of pilgrimage for people from all over the world. So during the summer, it's absolutely packed with busloads of tourists that drive all the residents mad.
Do the locals hate the tourists?
Yes, of course they hate the tourists, but they're very happy to take their money,
right, sure,
when they come. But the other thing about it is that it's not a Western society. It's a traditional Middle Eastern society in many ways, even though it's more Western than other Middle Eastern societies. What that means is that you have a different rhythm to life, a different pace of life. You have a rhythm of life that is governed by religious festivals. So the Jewish religious festivals of Passover and Tabernacles. Tabernacles is a festival when Jews build little booths in the garden or on their porches if they're in an apartment block, and they live in them and they eat in them. And so for a week during the late autumn, you see these little booths covered with leaves springing up all over Jerusalem, all over Israel, because that's what the Jews are doing. A Palm Sunday is just a date in the calendar in America. But Palm Sunday is when you have Christian pilgrims carrying palm fronds, walking through Jerusalem in the footsteps of the last journey of Jesus Christ on his way to the crucifixion. Ramadan in Jerusalem is a place when Muslims are fasting all day and partying in the evening. It's an extraordinary place.
Matthew Kalman's books include The Murder of Yasser Arafat and Psycho Bibi. He's in town to speak to the annual meeting of the American Jewish Committee tonight. Matthew, it's been such a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.